Антикоррупционная Москва, столица России, сегодня вернулись протесты.
Акция против коррупции прошла сегодня в принципиально новом формате.
Я здесь, потому что я неравнодушна к судьбе своей страны.
Tens of thousands take to the streets in scores of Russian cities, taking the Kremlin by surprise. Unusual rumblings of dissent in the regions, suggesting that Vladimir Putin's base is getting restless. Growing anger across Russia about official corruption, and a new generation finding its political voice. No, revolution's not in the air. The regime's not about to fall. Alexei Navalny is not about to storm the Kremlin, and 2017 is certainly not the new 1917. But these were not your father's anti-Kremlin demonstrations. And a new chapter in Russian politics appears to have commenced. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
And also joining us in the studio is journalist Anna Aratunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Welcome back to the podcast, Anna, and welcome to Prague.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks. Good to have you here. So this week, it was easy to have a sense of deja vu. On one hand, just as in 2011, 2012, there is a sense that something very important has changed. There's a sense that the Kremlin's aura of omnipotence has been pierced. But on the other hand, everybody knows how 2011, 2012 ended, with a harsh crackdown and dissent followed by a military adventure in Ukraine. So there's suddenly a sense that Vladimir Putin's regime feels threatened, but there's also a sense that the regime is very dangerous when it feels threatened. Alexei Navalny unexpectedly managed to land a punch last weekend, and now we're awaiting the Kremlin's counterpunch. And how Navalny, his supporters, and the rest of society will respond to that counterpunch. On the blog this week, I outlined five reasons why these protests were different and important. They were led from the regions, not Moscow. There were unprecedented numbers of young people present. And they were driven by corruption and its connection to pocketbook issues. In many cities, including Moscow, there was no official permission. And the usual protesters and opposition leaders were not on center stage. Arresting Navalny at the start of the demonstrations in Moscow and attempt to decapitate the protest did nothing to stop it. Mark, you put out a video explainer this week in which you also argue that something important just happened. This isn't Bolotnaya. This isn't 2011, 2012. But this situation is... Do you see this situation more or less dangerous for Putin's Kremlin?
I think it's more dangerous. Not, I agree with you, because I think it's going to lead to some kind of imminent storming of the ramparts. If they want their own Great October Revolution, they're going to have to be moving quite quickly. No, I think what this suggests, though, is that one of the kind of the great tectonic shifts that we've been waiting for might actually have started to take place, which is, in other words, the point at which Russian people begin to see the regime and Putin not as the guarantors of their economic as well as political security, but instead as part of the problem. Exactly. This is not like Bolotnaya. Bolotnaya was explicitly political, and it was much more of a metropolitan middle-class phenomenon. This, on the other hand, has the potential, and I would stress that, the potential to be something actually that is much, much more generic, because the corruption and how corruption impacts people's lives issue is something that actually can cross all the usual regional, class, even national boundaries within Russia.
Anna, you had a piece for the European Council on Foreign Relations this week, quite a good piece, in which you argued that these protests went beyond Bolotnaya in many ways by focusing on the corruption issue. Could you expand on your thoughts?
Yes, I had four reasons why they go beyond, and I would partially agree with Mark here that they do present a completely unexpected way for things to develop, exactly because they kind of go beyond politics. They go beyond Putin. Now, the first reason is, like you said, this started in the regions and ended up in Moscow. Which is pretty unprecedented for the way that protests usually pan out. They start in Moscow and maybe get to the regions, or they start in the regions and don't really get to Moscow.
And if I'm not mistaken, some cities, particularly St. Petersburg, had more people than Moscow.
I think so, yeah. And the fact that the regional protests started before, and that Navalny's organization focused on the regions initially, not Moscow. Moscow was kind of impromptu. That says a lot about the organizational capacity. So I would say, one, that it started from the regions and reached Moscow in a very robust manner. Two, that this was organized in a very coherent manner by one man and one organization, which is also unprecedented for the Russian political opposition. Three, that they didn't make it entirely about Putin, and this is very important, I'll get back to this later, and that this was about corruption, that this was about something that Navalny has been doing for years, and this is a culmination of that process by which he is basically coaching Russians, coaxing them into trying to stop normalizing corruption, trying to stop thinking about corruption as an inherent part of the way that they should be, that they are ruled, as an inevitability. He's kind of breaking the idea that Russian state power owns what it rules. And he's doing this in very interesting ways. Now, to get back to Putin, why I think this is important is by making this about Medvedev and not Putin, by making this, I mean, yes, people went out and said, down with Putin, Putin is a thief, the usual. But the focus and the point was not that. The point was Medvedev, the point was Navalny's film about Medvedev, and the point was corruption. They're kind of shifting the attention away from Putin and focusing on actual issues.
And you seem to argue that by making it this more limited thing, not bringing down the regime, but focusing on corruption and on Medvedev, that this is more effective, but in the long run could be more dangerous for the regime. Did I understand your reasoning correctly?
Yes, yes. I mean, in right now, why is this effective? It's because it's breaking a long pattern of protests by which, you know, you go out, you protest the regime, down with Putin. Everybody knows that's not going to happen. The Kremlin can't just go away. You can't ask the Kremlin, go away, and the Kremlin's going to go away. It's not how it's going to work. And both sides know that. There's kind of an implicit, like, acceptancy of this isn't going to go anywhere, built in from, like, and this was the case with Bolotnaya. Yes, they made it about rigged elections. They had a demand, like, what were they asking for?
Free and fair elections.
Free and fair elections, but essentially that means, and I might be disagreeing with Mark here in a bit, but that's going to be an interesting point, because I think the paradox here is that by focusing on an issue like Medvedev, that can be, theoretically at least, dealt with by the Kremlin.
And
you're
it
allowing
is,
them that chance.
It's fascinating the degree to which how quickly Medvedev has gone from being this buffoonish figure, affable, buffoonish, but buffoonish nonetheless, to being this object of national anger. Either of you noticed, he was tweeting yesterday from the Arctic during his trip with Putin, and the responses to the tweets were just really telling. Did you steal anything? There's nothing up there to steal. I bet your jacket's really expensive. You know, it's amazing the degree to which that they've turned Medvedev into a lightning rod, and one has to wonder how much this helps or hurts Putin. That's another question along these lines of all the angers directed at Medvedev. This some have been arguing this might actually help Putin. Mark, I know you had some thoughts.
I don't feel that it does help Putin. Because in theory, of course, he could now jettison Medvedev and say, there you go, in fact, he was corrupt. But first of all, he would have to be trying to suggest that somehow my prime minister managed to accumulate all this ill-gotten wealth.
And I'm shocked.
And exactly. I mean, you know, it works in the Casablanca scenario. It doesn't work here because, you know, remember, so much of Putin's foundational legitimacy is exactly he's the guy who knows everything. He's the guy who's in charge of everything. So in that respect, he can't just simply play that particular card. Secondly, if Medvedev goes now, then it looks like it's precisely a concession to the street.
Which Putin abhors.
Which, exactly, and becomes quite an empowering thing. And yet, conversely, Medvedev stays, then he continues to be this sort of sump of opprobrium. Thirdly is, look, this is systemic. Everyone knows that. I don't think anyone is honestly claiming that you have an extraordinary, upright and dedicated ruling elite with one bad apple sitting in the prime ministerial chair. In this respect, Medvedev has become a symbol. But the thing is, and again, this is why it's effective, not only by not going after Putin do they not cross that particular red line and sort of escalate things with an immediate challenge. It has precisely given the illusion that there is something Putin can do. In practice, actually, he cannot unpick this system. And even if Medvedev goes, that's not going to be the end to it. Because then, whoever comes in next, how long before Navalny is able to show a video with that particular person's vineyards and duck houses?
Right. Right. Now, I want to zero in on two of the things that have gotten everybody's attention about last weekend's protests. The regional variant. I mean, this suggests that maybe the opposition has finally broken out of the cosmopolitan bubble of Moscow and Petersburg and is actually connecting with the quote unquote real Russians in the provinces. And the second is this notion of the new generation coming out to protest. In the weeks before this, you saw videos of students arguing with their teachers. There's the famous one out of Bryansk. After the protest, you saw a university professor in Tomsk and his students going at it about the protests. You had the conservatory student in Moscow mockingly reading out the names of enemies of the people when the professor asked him to do this. That professor later had to resign, incidentally. And you had a whole series of these things. So let's take these one at a time. What about the regions? Have we broken through the logjam on the regions? Anna, what do you think?
I think we have, again, because this has been made about corruption and not about democracy and human rights. I mean, that these things don't contradict themselves, but if you take even surveys, and I mean, we should take surveys with a grain of salt. They don't like determine everything, but they do suggest that the sentiments in the regions have not been really taken seriously by the opposition. Currently, 39%, according to Levada, not currently 2013, see corruption as their main concern. About 4% see democracy and human rights as their main concern. I don't think previously the opposition has really dealt with that problem.
But Navalny's been dealing with it forever.
He has, but it takes practice to reach that level of organizational skill where you can use a single foundation, his anti-corruption foundation, to do several things, to create this investigation, to make this movie, to get activists involved, to rally supporters, to reach out to people and basically speak their language. Because I don't think that's what the liberal opposition has really been doing.
So this is a watershed in terms of the oppositional elites in the capital reaching out to the provinces. This is something we haven't seen before, and that in itself is almost revolutionary, no?
I think so. I think it is very revolutionary. Not in the sense that, I want to stress here, that this does not mean now we're going to have these protests and they're going to overthrow the Kremlin. No, that's not how, that's not the trajectory. The trajectory is they've reached a certain level of organizational skill where they can achieve things, be that organizing protests or getting people out of jail, or perhaps more meaningfully, even lobbying for things to get done on a more, higher up level.
Mark, what do you think? Have we crossed a threshold here in the regions?
Well, I think we certainly see lessons being learned. One of the key weaknesses of the Blotnay era was precisely the complete and utter and shambolic failure to create any kind of political machine, any kind of an organisation which is able to actually follow through. You know, there's only so far that Twitter allows you to go. And they've learned the lesson.
140 characters, to be exact.
But now we have people who actually, are looking for ways of building in the regions. But also, when we talk about the regions, it's also in some ways a synonym for poverty. Generally speaking, the regions are poorer than Moscow and St. Petersburg. We're talking about rather different types of people. And also, we're talking at a time in which actually many regional elites are becoming a little alarmed by the situation. You know, we have this increasing squabble over the amount of money that Moscow puts out to the regions. And we actually have quite a few regional bosses beginning to express their concerns about that.
Tatarstan, now, for one.
Beyond, I mean, anyway, Tatarstan is in some ways the easy one, but because that's always had a certain degree of protection, and also Tatarstan is a net contributor rather than a net receiver. But generally, and obviously, you know, regional elites, these are the guys who are the front line. These are the guys who actually have to keep things working. I mean, in some ways, these are the equivalent of the local party bosses in Soviet times. Mm. And it was the collapse of that system, which is one of the key elements in the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, again, we're nowhere near that point yet. But you might say, so generally speaking, we have populations that feel disproportionately they're suffering economically at the moment. You know, more than half of their take is going on food alone. We then also have that the people who are in charge of making sure that they think the right things, or at least do the right things, are themselves feeling a little bit more dispirited, a little bit less willing to basically be Moscow stormtroopers. At the same time as the fact that you now have a Moscow-based organization which is properly reaching out and actually realizes that it can't just simply wave a metaphorical flag in a square in Moscow and expect the whole country to see. It has to find ways of reaching out. And the video was a very, very effective way of doing this, particularly because the video was linked with... I hesitate to kind of, you know, compare politics with selling sort of plastic storage boxes. But it was that same level of almost multimedia marketing, multi-level. You know, they were actually, you know, Navalny was saying, you know, basically invite some people round and show them this. You know, your granny doesn't know how to use the computer to watch a YouTube video. Show it to her so she can show her friends. It was this actual attempt to build a grassroots network. And okay, long way to go, but this is something that is real.
Well, we saw the results and something happened. And this video wasn't the first time Navalny aired these allegations. He aired them in a shorter video that came out a while back. But to put it out in a video of this length, this slickly produced, and it was really slickly produced. I was pretty impressed by that. So the other thing I wanted to hit is the young people. Everybody's talking about this. And everybody's playing it to their advantage. The Kremlin saying, "Oh, it was just young people; they're easily manipulable. They're following some Pied Piper. They were paid to come out there." And on the other side, you know, young people being beaten at demonstrations and hauled off by the police—that's horrible. So everybody's using this thing. When you look at it, yes, there were more young people there, but if you look at it statistically, of those detained in Moscow, the percentage of young people is actually quite small. But has something happened here with the youth? Because it's interesting. This is a Kremlin's paid a lot of attention to youth. I had to laugh this week when I saw pieces in the pro-Kremlin press saying, we have to, you know, the Kremlin needs to get a better youth policy. The Kremlin's always had a youth policy. Have these people heard of Nashi? You know, and all of these things that followed in its footsteps. Have they lost the next generation, or is this hyperbole?
Look, no one gets the next generation. No one wins them or loses them or whatever. I mean, even the whole kind of Putin youth structures that we've seen in the past from Nashi onwards. Actually, the level of footprint they had on Russian youth was pretty limited, and it very quickly simply became a kind of a career track for a lot of people and so forth. You know, instead, look, you know, young people are much like other people, except perhaps, yes. I mean, as a university professor, I would have to say, but sometimes a little bit dimmer. No, I don't mean that at all, of course. No, I mean, in the sense of, look, actually, they are much more likely to be motivated by practical issues, as well as, I mean, yes, of course, there's also the idealistic ones. But I think one of the key things is precisely that the reason why the youth... participation was important is because these are the people who are looking at the world 5-10 years, the future. They're looking at the trajectory. And the point is that whereas until relatively recently, it was possible to look at the trajectory of Russia and think, things are getting better, maybe not as quickly as we would like, maybe not in not all the directions that we would like, but broadly speaking, life is getting better, comrades, life is getting brighter. But now we have a situation in which actually people are looking and they're seeing sort of even with the sort of current limited but real resurgence of the economy. But nonetheless, there is a general sense that actually the next few years are going to be rougher and certainly rough. I think the optimism has been broken. And therefore, I think that's what's particularly important about the presence of young people. It is in some ways a signal that there are people who do not think history is on the Kremlin's side. Mm.
Now, I'd actually make it even a little bit more banal than that. I mean, it's been pointed out, these young people are much less likely to be watching Russian state television, which means they're kind of inoculated to the biggest propaganda tool the Kremlin uses. And young people, they like cool, hip things. Let's face it. They like cool. Everybody likes cool. I like cool. But young people especially like cool, hip things. And Navalny's kind of grabbed the cool mantle right now. I mean, he's in. So that this is, and I think you can't underestimate that in terms of its ability to motivate young people. Would you agree on?
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching Navalny kind of closely from the beginning, and he always had that cool thing going for him. You know, he was always like on Twitter making fun of rap videos, making fun of somebody's sneakers, and now he's just made a whole thing out of it. But it was there all along. It was there from December 2011. It was there beforehand when he was starting out as a lawyer, as a debater. But I think one point that needs to be made about the young people, well, two points, actually. One is that, yeah, we, at this point, we don't know exactly the statistics of their participation. I mean, we look at the pictures and it looks like a lot of young people.
This is all based on anecdotal thing. The only thing I saw was I forget the statistics and I don't have them in front of me, but the percentage of young people, there's a piece in Open Democracy about this, about the percentage of young people arrested in Moscow. Now, whether that is representative of the percentage of young people who attended as a whole, but it was fairly small.
And Volkov of the Levada Center said that we don't really have these statistics, and we have to keep in mind that every protest wave includes a lot of young people. That's just how young people are. Now, this one might or might not be different. We don't have the, you know, hard proof for that. But if, I mean, I think what we really are seeing is what happened before, the fact that these youngsters were talking about this with their teachers, that these videos mm-hmm. were leaked, that this conversation started among young people, really young people, before the protest happened. And another thing, and this goes back to how the Kremlin is really hard-pressed to respond to this, is that even with Bolotnaya in 2011-2012, one resource the Kremlin had to woo the young people were the 90s. Because more or less, they still remember those. I mean, one of the successes of Nashi, one of the ways that the Kremlin was able to exploit young people in the regions was play up on their fears of the 90s. And you can't really do that anymore because these kids don't remember the 90s. They have much higher expectations. And that's very important. Mm. That doesn't mean that there were more young people, but it just means that these young people, this generation, the same tactics the Kremlin has used to manipulate them is no longer working.
And they have to come up with something else. Mark, has Navalny monopolized the cool factor, and is that playing a role?
Well, I'm sure he has. The trouble is that could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing. Again, I think what it actually signifies is that this is only the start of this process. If it's cool that is appealing to the young, and my God, it makes me feel old talking about the young, the youth. but nonetheless, you know, if it is cool, then either that could easily, after a certain point, fade away. Difficult though it is to believe that anyone could think Navalny is cooler than Medvedev. Or it could actually begin to become something real. Something that is actually based on more than just simply this is what all my mates are doing and this is kind of countercultural and such like. But again, I think really what this stresses is this is the start of a process. If you know, the Navalny and co. cannot take that kind of youth participation for granted, because even if it continues, there's no guarantee that it'll sort of basically break their way. And now they actually have to sort of basically turn it into a real constituency.
I mean, it's interesting because he is really challenging, without saying so, but he's challenging Putin on his own turf here, because Putin did also make a conscious effort to have this kind of cool factor that appealed to the younger generation. And the shirtless videos and all, the whole tough guy persona, the Bond villain act, the whole thing appealed. Navalny's just as badass, right? And I guess, or he's kind of playing this game for this kind of intangible cultural space with Putin. Now, do you?
I think in different ways. These are two different types of cool. I think Putin was playing to an older, still nevertheless an older generation. And if he was playing to a younger generation, it was more in the sense of this sugar daddy at best. I hate to say it. I really hate to say this. I mean, sorry, but not sorry. Navalny is playing on this, I'm one of you. He's making this about equal terms. He's not making
rhetorically.
Himself, yeah, he's not playing this paternalistic figure at all. Now, he might if he were to become, I don't know, ruler. That's just what happens in Russia often. Maybe he'll break that mold. I don't know. But so far, as an opposition leader, his cool is kind of the I'm with you guys cool.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you can't really play the same cool card for 17 years and still have it feel at all current. I mean, firstly, Putin is 17 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, in
ways... More than that, no?
Well, I'm just thinking. I mean,
17 years older than when he came in.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But secondly, it's also that, in fact, this is a shtick that has been shown and shown and shown. And after a certain point, a shtick becomes, frankly, a caricature of itself.
And that's exactly what it's become.
People are tired of it.
I mean, it's even reached Saturday Night Live with the shirtless Putin. So it's kind of become a caricature. The other thing I wanted to touch on is that the Kremlin's. I'm not sure. I want to say their backs against the wall. But they do feel threatened right now, like they did in 2011. They felt threatened. They felt freaked out by this. And when they are freaked out, they are dangerous. And there's already been indications in the media and from statements from officials that Igor Zubov, the deputy interior minister, for example, said, you know, next time if this happens, we're really going to get tough. We're going to put the full arsenal of the as if they were kind of treating everybody with kid gloves last Saturday. Komsomolska Pravda had a piece calling for the use of everything from water cannons to RoboCops. I didn't even know Russia had. Do they, Mark? Do they have RoboCops?
No.
I don't think so. Of course not. but you get my. There's this call to really really crack down, and there's a sense that maybe could backfire. What are your thoughts?
This time in 1991. When Yeltsin was basically facing the challenge, as at that point, Russian leader within the Soviet Union, the communists were trying to get rid of him, and Yeltsin called on Moscow people to come out and march. And I remember, I was in Moscow at the time, and the night before, it was fascinating because the newsreader, while saying all protests are banned, then basically proceeded to catalogue all the means that would be used to deal with any protests. And it sounded precisely like the Komsomolska Pravda article, without RoboCops, I should add. They missed that particular one or whatever. But again, I mean, but the interesting thing is, but then the protests happened. And you had this massive, you know, very, very huge scale protests in Moscow. And the interesting thing was actually that it was dealt with relatively peaceably. Yes, they sort of, in a way, effectively channeled the protest around. They had a load of police and soldiers and OMON on the streets, and then when night fell and, you know, you only had the hardcore left, then there was more sort of rough stuff. But broadly speaking, the crowd called the authorities bluff, and that was the late Soviet authorities.
That was Gorbachev's Kremlin.
It was Gorbachev's Kremlin, but this was Gorbachev's Kremlin at the time when he was in his winter alliance with the hardliners. This is the kind of the Kremlin that had also sanctioned crackdowns in the Baltic states and so forth. So we shouldn't assume that everyone had assumed that they were all kind of flopping. Again, I mean, to me, actually, when you have to go to that kind of, again, almost ridiculous length, that actually is a sign of feeling that you are not being taken seriously. And this is one of the most worrying things for any authoritarian regime. It has to manage people's expectations. It has to manage people's fear. And obviously, I think there is a feeling, from the Kremlin's point of view, that the Russian population aren't fearing them enough. Which means, again, that they're going to be in a situation either they genuinely do make good on their threats, crack down in a particularly kind of gratuitously brutal way, and hope to basically give out the Tiananmen lesson.
Right.
The regime is tough. Don't even think of lying in front of the tanks because we won't stop. Or they're going to find that if they either try and do it and it doesn't sort of come off, if there's any resistance from within the police, I mean, this is one of the reasons for creating the National Guard, is concern about whether actually the police would always be fully loyal to their orders, or even if just simply when it comes down to it, the state decides not to use that. All of these essentially it means that actually the state itself is raising the stakes of this in actually a dangerous and unnecessary way. And it says something about the fact they don't really have a strategy. They're hoping they can just overawe. Well,
they're trying to pull out, it seems to me, the old Bolotna playbook. I mean, you saw it play out this week. There is the threats in the media to get tough. And if you watched Russian state television this week, I was watching the program Vecher on it was Tuesday night, and they were rolling out the whole "this was a Western plot" thing again. This is American political technology to do this, and so they're playing this whole fifth column thing again. Can they keep going back to that playbook? Does that playbook keep working? Maybe it does. I don't know. Anna, what do you think?
I would disagree that this is the same playbook. I mean, to an extent, yes, they're using the same rhetoric. They're using the similar threats. But I remember distinctly 2011, 2012, the earliest unsanctioned rallies when I was there. And I remember the violence, and I remember the violence around me, and it was not nearly anywhere to what I saw in the pictures. Now, again, I have to say I wasn't in Moscow on Sunday, and I wasn't there, but this level of brutality, I mean, the closest we'd seen was on May 6, 2012, on Bolotna Square, mm-hmm. that big rally after which Peskov said to somebody off the mic, "We're going to smear their livers on the pavement." Mm. That level of brutality just started with the first one. Now it looks, I'm scared to look where this is going to lead us, because in terms of is the Kremlin scared? Yes. I mean, bringing out that level of that response so early on. You have to remember that back in 2011 they were allowing rallies. Right. They said, okay, well, after the first unsanctioned one, they started giving them space on Bolotna, not on Revolution Square, right, but on Bolotna, in the hope that, okay, we'll let them let off steam and this whole thing will go away. That was the playbook. Yes, they will use threats. They will say that this is a Western plot. They will talk about fifth columnists. They will scare people. But the playbook was using that scary rhetoric along with letting them let off steam. And that doesn't look like, first of all, it's going to succeed this time. And second, the Kremlin doesn't look set on using it. The fact that Vladimir Putin postponed his
call-in show,
I think that's pretty worrying. I mean, there could be any reason for that, but I'd be surprised. Exactly. I think they're really worrying how to deal with this, because they don't know. The playbook no longer works.
Now, there was a piece on Vkontakte, there was a post on Vkontakte this week that caught my attention, calling for a protest this Sunday at Manishka Ploshet. It's unclear who's responsible for this post. But today, the prosecutor general's office called on the Roskomnadzor to block that site. I don't know what, if anything, is going to be going on this weekend. But you have to wonder how much farther this is going to go. Go ahead.
Just one very brief point also about the fifth columnist, which I mean, I definitely agree with Anna that this is a different thing. But also, anyway, the fifth columnist thing, I mean, in part, it's a warning to people who might want to participate, that in some ways we will treat you as fifth columnists. But it's also, it was something that back in Bolotna was easier to play, because this was primarily well-dressed metropolitans in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And therefore, they could tell the rest of the country that that's what was going on. It's a lot harder when you have almost 100 cities with these protests. And therefore, the odds of someone knowing someone or having been there or their kid being there is that much greater. And therefore, it becomes harder to kind of present this as the proper God-fearing part of the country against these Western-influenced metropolitans. So I think it's actually, again, it's a tactic that is much, much less effective this time.
Well, although last time the tactic was multifaceted. It wasn't just calling them fifth columnists. It was laws requiring NGOs with foreign funding to register as foreign agents. It was laws outlawing things like blasphemy. It was all sorts of things like that. This whole series of repressive measures, the greater controls on the internet, came in over a period of time when, as they were painting this as some kind of a Western plot. And I suspect they're going to go in that direction again because I don't think they can help themselves. I don't think they have anything else. No.
But the question is whether actually it can take. You know, again, when something is well away from your own personal experience and those of the people you know and your friends and people in your street, then it's easier to believe. If they say, "No, trust us, really, these people in Moscow, 1,000 kilometers away from where you live, yes, they were actually being stirred up by the CIA." But when it's actually that, you know, your cousin was at the local protest in your city, and therefore you think, well, surely my cousin is, to the best of my knowledge, not a CIA plant. You know, it's actually it works that much less.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth column thing was in part essentially a way of trying to basically pit one part of the country against the other.
Yeah, yeah.
The trusty Ural Vagon's foreman against the arty farty Muscovites and so forth. Not going to work as easily this time.
Mm. Now, it's my thoughts, and I talked about this in the Daily Vertical this morning a bit, is that it wasn't really the crackdown that saved the regime last time. If you remember correctly, they still were kind of in trouble well after they cracked down. It was basically Crimea that saved the regime, because regimes like Putin aren't propped up by force alone, but they're propped up by collective myths, collective hallucinations. And they had to find a new collective hallucination, and they found it in the annexation of Crimea and all the patriotic fervor that followed that, and the sense that Russia's back as a superpower. That drug's wearing off again. And so if we're going to have a repeat of Bolotnaya, and again, this isn't Bolotnaya, and we're probably not going to have a repeat, but if we want to look at that template, you would assume that if there's going to be a crackdown, if it's going to work, it's going to have to be accompanied by a new drug, a new collective hallucination. It doesn't necessarily have to be a foreign military adventure, but it's got to be something. Do you see anything out there? Is there anything left in the well for them to go back to?
I mean, certainly, look, in military terms, Crimea was an absolute aberration. It was both deeply symbolically important to the Russians, completely unprotected because of the virtual collapse of the Ukrainian state, and there also happened to be Russian troops sitting there. You really could not construct a better scenario. There is nowhere else that in any way meets any of those criteria.
I was actually looking at the map today, thinking if they want to do something, where can we get a small victorious war? And I mean, the best I could come up with is northern Kazakhstan.
I was just going to say, that's
not going to happen, and that's not going to do it.
No, exactly. No, no one's sitting there thinking, sort of, gosh, life will be so much better if Almaty were ours. No, I mean, I think this is it. I mean, there isn't anything from a military point of view. If anything, it's interesting that actually quite often Syria emerged in the narratives around this recent protest, precisely as a basically, we don't want Syrians.
We want roads.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, it's not actually...
That was in Irkutsk. That was
saying, let's have more. And it's hard to know. I mean, you know, obviously this is a regime that can always create mysterious bombs in apartment buildings or something else to happen. But I can't see anything that I think really would create much of a sort of a positive advantage and wouldn't be a terrible, terrible risk for the Kremlin.
Mm. Anna, you wrote a book called The Putin Mystique. And they got any more tricks up their sleeve? Is there another collective hallucination they can foist on the Russian people?
They've run out of tricks. They've run out of the mystique. I would only suggest, I've had this idea, what they could do, and they won't. But they could, it would help a lot of people steal a lot of money, is do a big dig. When we're talking about roads,
just, I mean an infrastructure project.
Yeah,
right?
do go all FDR on Russia. Just.
Well, that would be something.
Because the road grid is really, if you look at it, hasn't changed in 100 years. It has not, and that is also a central issue. No, they're not going to. They can't really fight corruption. But they can channel it to more productive means, have this, you know, whole road structure named after Vladimir Putin. That's legacy.
So go all Huey Long on them.
Yeah,
actually.
Just go for it. Your friends will get so rich. I mean, there'll be so much money to steal. And you'll have a road. Once Putin is gone, there'll be a road network, and that will be the beginning.
Well, you know, I mean, the election's coming up, and they've got to prepare some kind of narrative for that election. Now, they were planning on the narrative being Russia's return as a superpower. That was the planned narrative. Narrative, according to my reading of the pro-Kremlin press. I don't know if that's going to be sustainable in this environment. Although God, I'm certainly guilty of writing this regime off many times, and I'll be damned if I'm going to do it again and have them make a fool of me. So I'm not sure I'm ready to say they're. But I tend to agree with you, Anna. They seem to be out of ideas. I don't see what is left in the bag of tricks that they could come up with if this is sustainable. And that's something I want to talk about in the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and narrow the aperture a bit to take a closer look at the man who called these protests, is currently sitting in jail, but who many see as the main political beneficiary. Gee, I wonder who that is. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also with us in the studio is journalist Anna Aratournian, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Я очень рад быть частью этого всего, потому что мы видим, что
коррупция – это бедность.
Одно и то же. И когда мы выходим сейчас против...
Достаточно большое количество в России избирателей, которые не очень понимают...
He's become the Kremlin's Freddy Krueger with a Twitter feed and a YouTube channel. Every time they try to knock him down, every time they try to marginalize him, every time they try to neutralize him, he just keeps coming back. And Alexei Navalny has a knack for hitting Putin's Kremlin where it hurts. And although he's in jail serving a 15-day sentence, and although the FSB has raided his anti-corruption foundation, the dominant meme this week seems to be that Navalny has crossed an important threshold and become a national political figure. Now, we've been here before. During Navalny's first meteoric rise in the summer and fall of 2013, we were quick to say he was on the verge of seriously threatening the Kremlin. Mark, another false alarm? Because we were here right after the Moscow mayor's elections in 2013. We really thought Navalny had crossed an important threshold.
No. Yeah, and I think what that demonstrated was precisely that there is more to Russian politics than Moscow. Which is something that I'm sure any Muscovite has trouble with considering. And also we too.
Navalny seems to have considered it.
Well, this is it. But I think, you know, this is the point. I think he learnt the lessons from that. He learnt the fact that it needs to be a grassroots and national movement rather than a sort of essentially Moscow-based one.
Although he seems to be replicating in Russia what he did in Moscow, because his campaign in Moscow for mayor was extremely innovative. With these cubes set up around metro stations, he got around not having access to state media and really was able to connect with people in Moscow at the grassroots level in neighborhoods. I mean, you've never seen that kind of retail campaigning, or at least I haven't seen that kind of retail campaigning going on in Russia, and he damn near forced a second round against Sergei Sobyanin. I mean, yeah. So I think he took this national, no?
Well, this is it, but the point is, you can't do that quickly or easily, especially when you face the inevitable sort of consequences of having sort of tried to challenge the Kremlin's candidate and then sort of being cracked down. So, I mean, it's taken a while, but also, again, the circumstances were important. If one looks at, as it were, the sort of the two previous incarnations of Navalny's politics, there was the Bolotnaya phase, which was clearly it was about political process and about sort of we have not been given a chance to have our say, get rid of Putin and have proper elections. A very, very big macro issue, which matters to an extent, but doesn't necessarily affect the kitchen. Then when he moved into the Moscow mayor election, at that point he moved into real nuts and bolts issues. And what we actually now see is in some ways the sort of stage three, which obviously has taken time to develop, which is exactly taking a national level with all the energies of Bolotnaya, but on the other hand, the focus on why this really matters to everybody that we saw in his Moscow campaign. Mm. Now, again, I mean, obviously this is a huge country. There is a limit to how far he himself and his foundation and his initial network of people can do it. What this will depend on is whether he can enthuse other people to basically, on a local level, take up. You know, he needs a pyramid of mini Navalny's. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily just simply to do his kind of thing locally, but also as in a way, his block captains, the people who will relay and relay messages back and so forth. If he can build that,
well, party machinery here.
Well, this is it. This,
then
he will have built the party machine, which has always been this issue. I mean, I know I kind of harped on about the communists, the only people with an independent party machine. Well, and unfortunately, the communist leadership is totally sclerotic and basically compromised. So what Navalny is doing is, in a way, trying to see if he can create a second independent party machine from a completely different model from the communists. Now, if that is successful, then that makes him a serious player.
Anna, your thoughts? Because I do think he's crossed an important threshold here. And again, just like I've said the regime's on the ropes, I've also in the past said Navalny is, you know, has crossed an important threshold. But he does seem to have crossed an important threshold now.
Well, yes, I mean, these things take practice, and he had that moment to practice back in 2013. He did it really well. He has that knack for reaching out, for being media savvy, for using and exploiting all of the, I guess, the weapons of the new media at hand to reach out to young people, to speak their language, and not just to cosmopolitan young people, but just generally people of this generation, and that immediately set him apart from the opposition. There is that nationalist streak there that was there all along. His alliance with some more hardcore nationalists like DPNI, the Movement Against Illegal Immigration. And this, I mean, I've argued before, this is inevitable for a successful leader, for a successful opposition in Russia. For Navalny, this has made him more appealing to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, he's doing this very moderately. I don't think he's an ideological nationalist. Very much like Putin, I think Navalny is somebody who lacks that. He's not about ideology. He's not an ideological creature. That makes him very versatile. That makes him very adaptive to circumstances as they develop. Unlike the rest of the opposition, Navalny has managed to actually learn lessons from the past, from Bolotnaya. One of the biggest lessons that I'm seeing, again, in terms of outreach, is when Bolotnaya happened, the protest leaders were powerless to help people get out of jail. Navalny has mobilized lawyers. Being a lawyer himself, that definitely helps. But the fact that he's mobilized lawyers, not just, you know, politicians or activists or political scientists or spin doctors, but people who actually, you know, go out and can do stuff and have leverage, who know the law.
And he also has a track record of success in the European Court of Human Rights.
Yes.
And if you watch that video when he was detained and he was talking, only Navalny could turn an arraignment into a PR opportunity. But he was, you know, addressing the crowd in there in the holding area, saying, "Make sure everybody gets your documents. Do not leave here. Do not let them release you without your documents, because you're going to need them when I put your case before the European Court of Human Rights." And that was, I mean, it was pretty effective. Speaking of turning arraignments into PR opportunities, did you see the photos yesterday from his appearance in court? I mean, only Navalny could look cool handcuffed next to a big fat cop. but another thing that's really striking me about this is, like, I don't expect the Kremlin to let him on the ballot next year. I just don't expect them to do it. Maybe I'm wrong. But he's acting as if he's running for president anyway. Whether they put him on the ballot or not is almost irrelevant to him, is what it seems. He seems to be playing to a different election, almost. No? I mean, it looks that way to me.
Yes, and there was a recent interview with him where he somewhat addressed this issue. He said, yeah, it's unlikely they're going to let me run, but why do we not do anything now? Now, I remember a very important point in 2012 when I spoke to him, and he said to me that, I'm not running for election because this is not a real
right.
a real presidency, and I would be legitimating it. Now he's kind of changing his tack. No, you know what? Let's do what we can. Yes, it's not gonna happen. But again, this is about the long term. This is about practice, and whether or not the Kremlin lets him run, I think what he's thinking about. He's acting like a president is after the Kremlin collapses.
I think he's thinking that way too.
Of its own accord, that's when he moves in.
And he's also thinking about spoiling the Kremlin's show for the 2018 presidential elections, because he's going to be unless they physically stop him, unless they lock him up, he's going to be out there campaigning as if he's running against Putin, even if he's not on the ballot. And this is going to be fascinating to watch. Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that he's created a situation in which actually the Kremlin has no good options. I mean, if one thinks about it, look, yes, it seems to be that at one point they were toying with the idea of letting him run. On the same sort of principle as with Sobyanin, it actually does legitimate the eventual outcome when you win, and also because they're desperate to get the turnout up. And they, for this to be, remember, this is likely to be Putin's last election, unless something else mysterious happens. And this is meant to be a celebration and a coronation all at once, which means you actually have to reverse this current trend of steadily declining electoral participation. So I think, again, they thought a bit of theatre, a bit of fun,
switching it to the date of the Crimea annexation anniversary.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you know, for all these reasons, they wanted it to be an election with a certain amount of pizzazz. They've now realised that they have rather more pizzazz than they know what to do with. So, yeah, I think it's highly unlikely. And, I mean, put it this way, I think it would be disastrous for the Kremlin if they did let him run, because then they give him the biggest soapbox ever for his perspective, and do the one thing that is so crucial, which is actually a way of reaching out. I mean, they can't keep him off Pervy Kanal if he's one of the presidential candidates. So they basically can't let him run, which means that, yes, I mean, he will be either campaigning or in prison. Either way, it's a hit against the Kremlin. If he's campaigning, he will be undermining the plausibility, the credibility, even the seriousness of the genuine thing. You know, you'll have, God knows, Zyuganov or whatever there up there in the hustings. As the sort of fake opposition candidate, and then we'll have the real opposition candidate. Or he's in prison, in which case, actually, not only does it sort of create quite a domestic problem in terms of managing that story, but it also creates an international issue, or whatever. So I think for all these reasons, yes, of course, he's not expecting to have a chance at winning in 2018.
I think he's looking to 2024.
Much like the sort of, you know, the ultra-nationalists that Anna and I have written about, you know, who are also thinking in terms of, not how do we oust Putin, but how do we position ourselves for the post-Putin Russia? This is the game that really everyone is currently now squabbling over. And it's interesting, and it must be quite galling for Putin to realize that now people are actually thinking in post-Putin terms.
Yeah, it's almost irrelevant whether they let him run or not. What's relevant is whether they leave him at liberty or not. Which leads me to one of the other things I wanted to talk about here, and that's the base of his operations is this anti-corruption foundation. And they I think the Kremlin's figured that out. It's amazing it took them this long to figure that out, but they have. And they raided it. And, of course, they took all the computers. If they shut this down, does this shut Navalny down?
What's a foundation but a collection of people, computers, and a roof over their head? You know, as long as the people are still available, they can get computers and a roof over their head. I mean, I think, look, I don't believe for a moment that Navalny has not thought through the fact that this is likely to happen. And just as, for example, when they were broadcasting the protests, they had a fallback.
Right.
I mean, that. Well, certainly, I mean, I assume that Navalny either has planned a fallback or at least the people around him, because, you know, this is not just about one guy.
Right. Anna, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. They'll shut one thing down. Some other thing will come up. This isn't about a particular foundation. This is about things Navalny has been doing for years, and they preceded Bologna. So, I mean, the fact that he's managed to rally so many people, so they'll shut down this group of people, he'll rally others. It's about really a sort of know-how. A legal savviness, an introduction of legalism, if you will, that we're going to use the laws that Russia has and turn them right back against you.
So what do you think, as we bump up against the end of the program here, what do you think they do with them? What do you think? I know we talked about this off mic, but if you're the Kremlin, what do you do? If you're to game out the next moves against, I think we know what Navalny's next moves are going to be. What are the Kremlin's next moves here?
Yeah, I think, if I may, that they've already started this thing rhetorically. The Kremlin has started rhetorically pigeonholing this movement into the same familiar playbook that this is about regime change. You might be talking about corruption, but what you're really after is
Maidan.
Putin's
comments yesterday indicated that.
Yeah, that he's kind of like molding him into that role because that's a role that Putin knows how to handle better.
Right.
And if the problem here, I think, is if the Kremlin puts them into that mold again, and if they come back with their next protest in that mold, that's something that the Kremlin can manage better, and that's going to be something that for Navalny will kind of be a fail, I think. Mm. If they can stick with the corruption agenda, they will break through the Kremlin mold. They will keep themselves in a situation that the Kremlin is ill-prepared to handle. And if they keep at it persistently enough, they actually might force some kind of concessions. Eventually, not immediately. Putin's not going to do something now and make it like Navalny won. But eventually, down the line, certain things might start changing.
Mm. Mark, last word to you, because you keep us in the Enlightenment zone.
Well, what I imagine they'll do is continue this almost sort of cat and mouse, hoping to basically exhaust Navalny and his supporters in and out of prison, suppressing every sort of instance they can, particularly in the regions, identifying people they regard as particular kind of allies or agents and picking them off. I think, again, it'll be a case of if you can't go against Navalny, you can isolate him as much as possible. The trouble is, and although, you know, I mean, I know that I always tend to sort of push back about this notion that this is a Kremlin that kind of kills its enemies and so forth. You know, every overweight 65-year-old Russian who dies these days, it becomes a, well, why was he murdered by the Kremlin and so forth. But on the other hand, I can't help but wonder, at what point do you find some people thinking this is not a person that we can silence or isolate? We tried that and it hasn't worked. My biggest fear, and I think it's unlikely to happen, but nonetheless, my biggest fear is that precisely they arrest him, they stick him in a prison, and then he dies mysteriously in a sordid prison squabble as a way of getting him out there. Would it make him a martyr? Quite possibly. But to be perfectly honest, I think that actually a live Navalny is more dangerous at this point than a dead martyr.
Mm. Well, I hope you're not giving them some ideas here. On that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also with us in the studio has been journalist Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique, Inside Russia's Power Cult. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.